welcome to The Upshot, Multi-World Disc Golf's podcast about the latest in the disc golf world. I'm the publisher of Multi-World Disc Golf, and joining me is Jamie Thomas. Jamie?
Are you trying to catch Nate Doss right now?
What? I don't know what you're talking about. I was testing out my cadence and how to say your name. We got a great show today. We're going to be talking about Ledgestone and a couple, you know, another week and another pair of very interesting winners to talk about, Jamie.
Yeah, it's Ricky and the Cat.
And the Cat.
I love it, dude. Saki Bomb is back. It's so great to see what these wins meant to these players. You know, we saw it with Widboom at Idlewild, and we see two players that both have not won on the Pro Tour since the exact same tournament, the 2019 SFO. So
that's right,
420 something days, I think 26 days between their Disc Golf Pro Tour victories for both Ricky and Katrina, which was, that's kind of cool as well.
That is cool. And you know, let's be honest, both of these players have been going through it a little bit. You know, we're talking about major champions. We're talking about some of the greats of the game of the last 5 to 10 years. But they have been, by their standards, struggling a little bit over, you know, since that those wins on the Disc Golf Pro Tour. And of course, these things are relative. But, you know, if you go back and you look at what Ricky was doing in 2017 and even in 2018, I mean, he was like untouchable in 2017. He won some crazy number of tournaments in a row, and he won Worlds. And then, you know, he won a bunch of Pro Tour and National Tour events, played really well at the majors in 2018. And, you know, there were some moments in 2019 for Ricky, but, you know, he ended up finishing second at Worlds with a crazy final round, but it really wasn't in contention for most of it. And, you know, then we had the Lyme disease thing, and he's been struggling a little bit. And I mean, he'd been struggling even a little bit before the Lyme in terms of just winning events, which for him, I mean, that's the goal. And you could say the same thing about Katrina. This is somebody that's, you know, in the past dominated and has mostly been getting dominated by Paige Pierce for the last 12 to 18 months. And, you know, to come out and get this win has to feel so good for both of them, you know, although arguably for different reasons.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Katrina's struggles have been more mental, and Ricky's struggles have been a little more physical.
For sure.
Obviously, the Lyme disease is part of it, but, you know, that was still only in the last few months. This doesn't cover the entire time period of what you've been talking about. As you're saying that, I was actually just looking up Ricky's rating, and it actually doesn't, it kind of paints a little bit of a different story, so I want to hit you with this and see what you think. The last time Ricky was 1050 rated was March of 2018, so coming off that great 2017, multiple majors, multiple national tours, multiple pro tours, big season.
They're best player in the country at that point, in the world at that point.
Undisputed number one in the world that season. He had the best year. He actually hasn't been 1050 since March, so probably since like Waco, right around that ratings update. He dropped below 1050. Here's the other thing, though. He hasn't... he did get it briefly last year. September 2019, he jumped briefly for one ratings update to 1050, but it still goes with the point. The lowest he's been since then is 1042. So isn't that kind of funny? We sort of have been saying, oh, there's this kind of plateau of the Ricky Wysocki career, but he's never been more than, by rating, one stroke worse on average than when he was at his peak. Now, during that same time, we've seen the 1060 barrier shattered.
Right.
And we've also seen another player that wasn't Ricky break 1050 himself, being Eagle McMahon. But still very interesting, right? It's not as much of a fall off as it was just kind of a plateau a little bit. So, yeah.
But here's my issue with it. All right, let me tell you. And I got at this a little bit in either last week's show or 2 weeks ago. The ratings thing, yes, we need that objective standard, but it's a little dull to talk about ratings as like the meaningful metric by which we measure players. Because for Ricky Wysocki, if he's not winning an event, to me, that's an underperformance relative to his skill. And, you know, you could argue that that's not a fair point to make, but I mean, this is sports. I want to see who wins. I don't care if you, you know, shoot a great rating a bunch of the time and, like, you know, you finish in fifth place a lot. I mean, that's great. You're going to be considered an excellent player, but I want to know who's going to win. I want to talk about who wins. And for Ricky, that's the metric. I mean, there are other players where you wouldn't necessarily measure them based on whether or not they're winning. You know, Missy Gannon is somebody that we've been talking about who hasn't been winning, but has been playing really well because that, you know, relative to expectations, that is a story. But with Ricky, you know, yes, you know, he only goes from 1050 down to 1042, but that's a drop off for him. And I mean, you also, you definitely have to tip the cap. When Ricky went to Worlds last year and he finished in second place, one stroke behind Macbeth. Let me just pull this up. I just want to point this out because it shows you how good Paul Macbeth was. Okay. Here's Ricky's round ratings at Worlds. 1053, 1036, 1080, 1087, 1107. Okay, so he's over 1080 for the final three rounds, and he cracks 1100 in the final round, and he still loses by a stroke. Crazy. I mean, that goes to show you how good Macbeth has been. And it's not like Ricky just like disappeared from the face of the earth, but you know, he wasn't making the putts the same way, even before the Lyme disease stuff. Now, obviously, since then, he had, you know, missed some events, clearly physically didn't look right, and it took him a while to kind of like get into the rhythm. Now, you know, you could also maybe think about, you know, is there a part of this because he switched bags? You know, it took him a while to kind of get that rhythm back with the putter. But what we've seen in the last 4 to 6 weeks, really since the restart after COVID, is the Ricky of old, the Ricky that is crushing huge putts on a regular basis. And, you know, for Ricky, that really is, could be the difference between, you know, being a 1042 round and a 1050 round. It's like, are you hitting that putt that you, that we know you're capable of? So while I agree with your assessment, basically that he kind of like had a little bit of a plateau as Macbeth maybe went to a new level, I also think that given the overall inflation of ratings over time that we know exists, you know, staying around the same number is actually falling behind the pack a little bit. But again, it's great to see Ricky back playing at this level again, because, you know, to the eye test and not just to the ratings test, he is back playing the way that he was playing when he was in 2017 dominating. He was amazing this weekend at Ledgestone.
Well, I think the one point you have to differentiate, and we do this in disc golf, and I actually don't think it's very fair. We judge by wins far too much, and it's kind of becoming a little bit of a ridiculous limb to stand out on just to judge by wins, because we're seeing so many great players beef up what we traditionally call the middle of the pack, and we're seeing those upper middle players on tour reach up and try to take some wins. I mean, I can use kind of the same topics we're talking about here. Talk about Paul Macbeth, Ricky Wysocki. Well, they did change bags. They changed companies. They're still the dominant players in the sport. They're still improving their ratings despite all that. But at the same time, you have only Eagle McMahon has more than one disc golf pro tour victory this season. So by default, only has the only player who has multiple tour victories this season. Everybody else just got one. So we're also seeing this kind of crazy level of parity that I think we're going to have to recalibrate our expectations a little bit, and we're going to have to say that podium is good enough. Like, we need to start counting that because of exactly what you said at Worlds. Like, you can't say Ricky was having a fall off, and I'm not saying you were, but you can't say Ricky is having a fall off when you just read off those rounds at Worlds and you still lose by one. It's like, damn, there's just one guy who is playing the courses one stroke better over five rounds, and that's a really, really small margin of error at this point in time.
I hear you, but I just totally disagree. I think winning is the thing. And like, sure, we can talk about players who don't win typically, and we can have interesting stories about somebody who's young and upcoming and those kinds of things. But at the end of the day, I want to talk about who is winning. And that overrides, you know, being in third is not that interesting to me. I mean, unless it's a player that totally comes out of nowhere, I just think like winning matters. This is sports. Like if somebody makes the podium at every tournament on the year and never wins a single event, you know, could they theoretically maybe be a player of the year candidate? It's possible. Because of the level of consistency, you know, we were talking about Calvin Heimberg. He has some wins, but also was finishing, you know, top three a bunch, although he's cooled off a little bit the last few weeks. I just think I'm going to define what I think of as great players based on who wins. And that means, you know, majors come first, and then you've got your pro tours and your national tours, and then you got everything else. And it's more than just, can you throw, you know, quality rounds? It's like, can you throw the shots you need to win in the pressure spot? That goes beyond your rating. That gets into deeper levels of skill and mental resilience and toughness and all those kinds of things. And I think that is, there's a reason that we want to gravitate to talking about the winners, because that's what's interesting.
Sure, but there's a little bit of difference in a sport like golf or disc golf too, compared to like a lot of the other big sports in this country and around the world, because yeah, you care about winners, but there's a certain level of standardization in the competition and in the playing field that allows you to compare wins, and it allows you to kind of make these I guess just comparisons is the word. Like, how can you compare a Ledgestone win to an Idlewild win? You can't. One tournament is three rounds, one tournament is four rounds, one tournament used one course, one used two courses, and you can't guarantee that kicks players get at different times during the rounds are anything the same. So I guess the concise way to phrase that is golf is going to be worth more than one stroke. Just the nature of the game of golf and the inconsistencies therein could be easily more than one stroke in the deciding factor. So I just think we... You always want to celebrate the winner. I totally agree with you on that. But we also have to look beyond just the winner, because you're going to miss out on some really great storylines, some really great golf.
Sure.
At the same time.
I'm not saying to completely ignore all the other stories, but you know, let me just give you this thought experiment.
Yeah.
Would you accept, let's say you're a pro player. Let's say I upgrade you and you get to, you know, you're a professional level player that can go out and not just be a donator out there on the pro tour. Okay, but the thing that I say to you is you play 900 level golf at every tournament for the year, except at the majors, which you win. Do you accept that? I mean, you make it 800 level golf if you want. I mean, you're straight garbage, except that you win the majors.
Player?
Yeah.
Oh, as a player, 100%, I'm going to accept that.
100%, right? Because we all understand that winning the majors, this is the pinnacle of the sport. This is the things that people are preparing for the most. And, you know, just simply playing well, coming in second, that's not good enough. Not. You want to win the majors. And if that means you're horrible every other time you play disc golf, I feel like most people are going to take that trade-off. Even if sure. It means that your rating is 1,000 or lower, I don't know.
But that also, that 10-20 player who has yet to crack the top 10 in a major is probably just fine with getting second.
100%.
I mean, not just fine, like you want to win, but if you're 20th at the last five world straight and then you get second, you're pretty jacked at the same time.
I mean, look at Greg Barsby, you know, kind of, he's a good player, not a great player. Goes out there doing his thing, and then he gets the world championship. I mean, what a moment. What a moment to, you know, to have that opportunity to be recognized as a great and as a major winner, despite the fact that he may never win another one again.
Yeah. I guess to summarize it, I think that complete players are going to always be hunting the wins. If you've got game in all phases and you're really just, you know, sharpening, and you're at the bleeding edge of all the different statistic categories. You know, Rick's a great long-range putter. He was a forehand dominant player developed a backhand and a roller game as he came out on tour, and he just has all these different things that he can do versus, like, I mean, let's use an example, somebody we saw this weekend, like an Andrew Presnell.
Mm-hmm.
Talented golfer, really good putter in the wind. You know, obviously from Missouri, he's used to putting in wind and has a style developed for it. Doesn't really have a forehand. I didn't see him. I didn't notice him using roller to great effect, for example, out on this weekend. And like he slowly started to tail off. But it was at the same time, it was a big win for him to be kind of up there. So it's just kind of two ways of looking at it. I definitely get what you're saying. Like, you got to hype the winners. And in this case, we definitely need to be hyping Ricky and Katrina because they overcame, like you said, off the top, they overcame a lot of things that have been plaguing them in recent history in order to come back. And on these courses, considering what happened at Worlds last year for both of them.
Sure.
That's really the exclamation point on these wins, in my opinion.
Great point. Great point. Here's a little fact. Okay, at least since June, there has been no MPO player under 1020 rated in the top five at a Pro Tour event.
Wow.
Isn't that kind of crazy? Like, despite the fact that, you know, there is that natural variance from week to week, and you have three-round events and you have four-round events, you're still seeing the top, you know, 10, 30-plus players separating themselves every single week to the tune of, you know, locking everybody else out of the top five. That's pretty interesting. Shout out to Walk in the Ulti World Disc Golf Slack subscriber for pointing this out and tracking this every tournament.
That's awesome.
But it shows you that consistency does win out, of course. And, you know, that's why we look at the world champion as being the most impressive major title. More rounds. The best player tends to rise to the top at that point. Anyway, let's talk a little bit. I don't think we expected to go down that path of discussing how to judge disc golfers. But let's talk a little bit about this weekend. I mean, Ricky dominates. I mean, look at the spread on the scores here. He's 35 under in four rounds. Macbeth, second place, 27 under. Chris Dickerson, third place, 21 under. I mean, that's not just a win from Ricky. That's a straight up dominant performance. And, you know, you think maybe in the back of your mind going into the final round, you know, maybe Paul's got a shot. Paul comes out and shoots a 13 under. It's the hot round. But Ricky doesn't blink. He shoots a 12 under. That's what I'm talking about when it's like, can you go under the gun? I mean, so many players other than Ricky Wysocki probably fold there. They get a couple bogeys early, and Paul is rip-roaring, and they fall apart, and they lose a big lead, and then Paul Macbeth walks away the champ. But Ricky, no problem, goes out there and has the second best round of the day at 12 down.
Yeah, it's really funny, actually, the parallels between MPO and FPO this past weekend, because in these cases, you have Ricky, who starts the final round with a 7-stroke lead. Earlier that morning, Katrina started her final round with an 11-stroke lead.
Right.
Both of them are run down, or attempted to be run down, by the 5-time world champions.
That's right.
Who outlasted them at Worlds, again, referencing that thing we were just mentioning. And there were points where it started to get close, closer in FPO, and you know, didn't really get too much in doubt for MPO, but phenomenal performances by both Paul Macbeth and Paige Pierce, and it was not enough. I mean, Macbeth threw a 1098 rated round. Paige Pierce threw a 1030 rated round in the final round to try to pull off the impossible.
Yeah,
frankly, and it wasn't enough.
What a monster round from Paige Pierce, by the way. I mean, 11 under with an eagle and no bogeys. Whew. Next best round of the day was 6 under. That was awesome. But, you know, Katrina. I'm so excited for Katrina because I've been saying it and saying it. And what do we see from Katrina this weekend? All right. Look at the stats. It tells you everything you need to know. Who led the tournament in Circle 2 in regulation? Katrina Allen. Who led the tournament in Circle 1 in regulation? Katrina Allen. This is what we see. She leads in fairway hits. She's been doing this. She leads tied with Paige Pierce in parked percentage. But what's been the problem, Jamie? We all know what it is. It's been the Circle 1X putting. She hasn't been able to putt well enough to win these events where she's leading in the categories where she's getting a shot at birdie, which, you know, as we know, is the critical measurement in disc golf. You've got to be able to go tee to green effectively, and Katrina has been arguably the best player at that even this season. But what does she do in Circle 1? She shoots 67% from C1X. And even if you take away some of the layups from the final round, that's still a very solid number. It's not an amazing number, right? You know, the leading Lisa Fakus, we know, great putter. She shot 84% from C1X on the weekend. You know, north of 80 is very strong in FPO. But 67% is totally fine. That's fine. And that's all Katrina Allen has to be on the green in order to win an event and have an 11-stroke lead going into the final round. I mean, you saw it out there this weekend. She absolutely had it with the putter in a way that she basically hasn't for, I mean, over a year.
She credits her mental coach. She's been working with the legendary Natalie Holokoi over in Europe. She's been getting some mental coaching from her. She talked about it when we did some interviews with her on the broadcast and how that's really helped her. And, you know, frankly, that was anybody could see that it was a mental block, because the putts that she has been missing routinely, and especially at Worlds last year, that's really where it became so painfully obvious for fans around the world, when she lost a page, just not being able to put the disc in the basket from 10 feet out.
Right.
Despite getting it to 10 feet off the tee.
Almost inexplicable misses.
Yeah, that discrepancy in skill level to get there, and then to you know, just F that up so badly, frankly. Like, that's a mental thing. That's not a physical thing. That's not a skill thing. That's just purely between the ears. And at the end of the day, like, she was hitting big putts. Her numbers aren't that impressive, but the video of the putts she was hitting reminds you that, yeah, she can putt. It's not something that, like, she can't do. It's just something that she hasn't been doing. And so, of course, I'm sure she's been frustrated. As a golfer, does anything piss us off more as golfers than missing makeable putts?
No, it makes you want to rage, like, throw your bag in the lake.
I'd rather hit every first available tree in a round and putt 100% inside the circle.
I think I agree.
Then get in the circle on every hole and putt 30-40%.
It's very aggravating.
It's just like, God, just get in there. And that's what she did. She made these massive circle 2 putts. I mean, she went back-to-back eagles. She had an eagle look every day on that par 5. And she missed the last two. Got the first two. So, mm-hmm. You know, Paige tried to put pressure on her, tried to make that putter falter, make that, you know, doubt creep back in. And what did Katrina do? She goes, okay, I got 11 strokes. I'll just lay up. All right, I'm not going to test myself. I'm not going to bring in that. Like, she was fine giving up strokes down to only being up by 3 with, like, 3 or 4 to play.
Smart golf. Smart golf. Right. I mean, I don't care how much you win by. If you win, you win.
Totally.
So, you know, this is the path to victory for Katrina Allen. If she can unlock, like, elite level putting, then, I mean, she's going to be amazing and she's going to be dominating. But I think, you know, maybe that ship has sailed. I mean, she's not been an elite putter, really, from Circle 1X anyway, for a long time. She's a very good Circle 2 putter. You know, she was up there in the numbers this weekend behind, you know, the number one player we're going to talk about in a second, because, oh my, 36% from C2 and 76% from C1X. And see, before we tell you who that is, see if you can guess who that was. But this is the way for Katrina to win. Be at the average in C1X putting and do everything else great. That's fine. That you're gonna win a lot of tournaments doing that. Maybe she won't beat Paige Pierce on the big open bomber courses, but anything else where there's woods, where you need more technical lines. I mean, Katrina Allen shapes the lines better than anybody on tour and has power. So, you know, a well-deserved win, and it's cool to see her get back to the top of the leaderboard.
No doubt. I'm ready to talk about this putting phenom.
All right. Well, I know you already know the answer, but throw it out there. Who is it? And this person, by the way, is leading all of on tour in 2020, leading both C1X and C2 putting. It is not Lisa Fakus.
It's not Missy Gannon.
It's not Missy Gannon.
There are actually two players that you could have this conversation about right now, but the player that we're talking about is Heather Young. And
the future.
I mean, my God, it's basically the present, the way she putted on Sunday. I feel like we spent a lot of time talking about her this past weekend, and in my opinion, deservedly so. She hit 12 Circle 1X putts during the final round. 12 for 12.
Insane.
Circle 1X putting. Now, downside to that, she's got to hit those putts because she does not have the distance
right
that these other lead card players have. You know, probably I'm looking at the top. I'm looking at like the top 10 players down to Ellen Widboom. And I think Heather's probably gives up distance to every one of them.
Yeah.
I mean, she probably has 325, 330 on a golf line.
She's in the bottom half in circle one in regulation at the tournament.
Yeah. And look, she's a rookie. She's young, obviously. She'll develop that. I spoke to her dad, who was telling me, he's been sending me messages letting her know that like Heather's sister was playing in the Idlewild event, Amanda Young. So the whole family's getting into it, and he was telling me, yeah, they've been trying to work on distance and working with some of the other players that throw really far to kind of learn from what they do. So I think that's great, and she'll develop that. But for right now, her putting is probably putting her up in the conversation with players that maybe she shouldn't quite be in the conversation with yet, based on what they can do off the tee versus what she can do off the tee. But my God, when you get to the green, there's just no comparison. She's making 40-footers. She's making 40-footers without stepping. Just easy. Easy 40-foot spin putts.
I mean, it's not even really close right now. Like, she is the best putter on tour. Whether you look at C1X, she stands alone, 80% on the season. That's best on tour. Circle 2, 25%. That's 4% better than second place Haley King at 21%. I mean, Haley King's a great putter too, but Heather Young has got that title. These young players are learning to putt. And that is going to be interesting to see as like they develop the experience and the distance required to compete with the Pages and the Katrinas of the world. You know, once they get that, look out.
Yeah. Haley King is exactly who I was thinking of too, by the way. A very, very good long-range putter, like a Ricky-style long-range putter. When her arm swing is consistent, you know, she's just flowing and not thinking about it, she just ranges them, and she has so much energy on the putt that it just feels like you could putt 60, 70 feet without an issue. So, whoo, you got to watch out. Heather Young, Haley King, Missy Gannon. You know, Missy's a little older, though she is younger to the tour life. But all three of these players who we've talked about since the tour restart in FPO, really, really standing out. And it's been impressive to watch them.
All right, we got to talk about this as well. Chris Dickersunday. If Chris Dickerson Sunday performances were a player, it would be the highest rated player on the planet. We've got to talk about this. Look at this guy. I mean, I know this is becoming a meme, but like, he's got three straight events of shooting over 1080 rated rounds in the final round on Sunday at a Disc Golf Pro Tour event. What is going on here?
I mean, he said it. He had a bad second round at Northwood. It just beat him up. And I don't know if it's fair to just call Chris Dickerson a woods player. Obviously, his ability, like the way he putts, so straight line, basket height, you know, you can kind of pick those lanes between the trees on the wooded courses. So he definitely stands out. But Northwood's got the better of him, you know, even though you might not expect it because of his reputation and where he plays out of in the tournaments he likes to win. But he came back, and that's the thing. It's just like, can he start getting to these lead cards? If he could get to the lead card by Saturday, then, I mean, Sunday he'd be winning some of these tours. So it's the proof's right there. Pro Tour's got some slides of graphics on their Instagram. Go check it out. You can see exactly the rounds he's shooting and what they're rated. It's just he keeps playing from behind. And though we have had two chase card winners on the Pro Tour this season, it's still an incredibly tall task. And it requires everybody in front to not play well during the final round, which was not the case this past week.
And it's not going to. You can't count on that.
You can't count on the fact that it's happened twice.
You know, Ricky, Calvin, you can't count on them all to have a bad round. It's not going to happen.
Right. I mean, it almost did at Idlewild. D-Glow.
Right.
But
I think it's fun to talk about the fact that he's playing so well on Sunday, but, you know, you're bringing up the right topic, which is that he's got to play better earlier in the tournament. Like, you can't just show up and warm up over three rounds and then play amazing in the final round. And it's not just happening at tournaments like Ledgestone where they play two different courses. I mean, it's happening where they play the same course 3 days in a row. So I wonder if maybe he needs to get to a course earlier and play more practice rounds or something. Because, you know, you can't go out there and lay an egg in the first round of the event and expect to then be able to come out and get the win, no matter how well you play in the final round. And, you know, you look at the numbers like 10:36 opening round at DDO. That's not bad, but that's not great by his measures. You know, 10:40 rated round to start at D-Glo before then going 10:64, 10:80. And I mean, this is the same story. 10:10 at Idlewild to open up, and you know, obviously the second round at Ledgestone, he shot 9:93. I mean, by his standards, that's terrible. But even his opening round was 10:38. I mean, that's only a little bit below his rating, but he's consistently shooting below his rating at the beginnings of tournaments. He has the tools to be winning these events. You can see that. But he's got to figure out what is going on. And to me, it's either like lack of practice or some sort of mentality issue that he needs to address.
Well, you said it. The opening rounds, the other side of that exact same coin, when you're talking about Sunday Dickerson, 10:80 rounds on the last three events he's played on the final day, the first three events, or during those three events, the first rounds that he's played have all been below his rating at the time. So, and look, you know, I'm not going to sit and say a 10:40 round is a bad round. I've never shot a 10:40 round in my life. So it's still a very, very good round, but if your metric is winning, you can't go below rating, especially if you're not the highest rated person in the tournament. So you got to get it. You got to keep it consistently a stroke or two above your rating, which is 10:55 to 10:65. If you take the 10:40 round, the 10:38 round, and the 10:10 rounds, those are his opening round ratings, and you put them above rating at 10:50, I'm pretty sure, let's see, he would not have won Ledgestone because
Ricky was just on another level.
Yeah, but he theoretically, in this very not applicable math I'm doing, he theoretically would have won Idlewild and D-Glo. It's the differences in the first round is the point I'm getting at.
Yeah, right, exactly. And, you know, it's something to address. It's something to address because it's clearly, I don't know what the issue is. I mean, he's basically said as much, like, I need to be better in the first round. 100%. Like, that's the difference between finishing in third and winning. It really is. And it's pretty interesting because, you know, he'll play the same course three times in a row and get better each day. To me, that's a sign that, hey, he needs to get out there and play two or three practice rounds, get the, you know, knock the rust off, get used to the course before starting the event, so that it's not happening. You're not warming it up. You're not warming up on the course as you're playing tournament rounds. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more on Ledgestone. We've got some media conversations to have. We've got to talk about Sunset Hills. We got to talk about the backups at Northwood and how brutal they were, and whether there needs to be any adjustments made for that front. Jamie, we'll have to also, you know, you can go take a nap after all of the broadcasting that you had to do this past weekend.
Oh, there were naps happening. I thought you meant like during this break. I did.
That's what I meant.
This weekend.
That's what I meant. You're still recovering.
Yeah, perfect. I'll see you guys in 20.
All right, we'll be back in 20.
The Upshot is brought to you by Pound Disc Golf. Based in Portland, Oregon, and producing all of their fantastic disc golf backpacks in Oregon, Washington, Montana, Pound Disc Golf supports U.S. manufacturing with 90% of their materials from the United States and 100% of the labor. Check out the new Octothorpe Custom Pack Builder on their website, PoundDiscGolf.com, where you can create your own perfectly designed colors you want, zipper colors you want, everything about the pack customizable. You can find out more at PoundDiscGolf.com in the Custom Octothorpe Builder.
Welcome back to The Upshot. Real quick, a little bit of news. I actually just wrote it up this morning, and I only really found out maybe 2 hours ago, Jamie. Winthrop University has given the thumbs up for the USDGC and Women's National Championship to take place in October as scheduled. So that, you know, that was still in doubt about whether or not the university, I mean, you can understand too, they're, you know, starting classes late. The Big South, the athletic conference that Winthrop is in, is canceled all fall sports. So there are big questions about whether even a scaled down, spectator free USDGC and Women's National Championship event was going to be allowed to be on campus at Winthrop. But they've given the okay. So it's all systems go. And I understand that, you know, they're already right away starting to work on, you know, coming up with course changes, thinking about T-pad and pin placements for the FPO layout. So more to come on that front, but looks like we're going to have some majors in 2020.
Very exciting. Yeah, I mean, think about it. Just a few hours up the road, 3 hours or so up the road, up in the Triangle, UNC Chapel Hill already has COVID clusters reported when they went to in-person classes. So they turn around and shut that down real quick.
Right.
So, look, Winthrop, yeah, and I'm sure everybody will. I just hope everybody continues to follow guidelines and everything, because you just know, like, a respected, revered university just a few hours up the road cancels on, like, has that happen, that could get administrators at another university real nervous all of a sudden about how they want to handle things. So, you know, good on, I'm glad it's still happening, definitely, obviously. You know, hoping to be back there and a part of the event as I have been, but good to hear. It's just good to hear right now.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit of good news is nice to have. I mean, you know, you can't, I don't think you can say with certainty that, like, it's 100% going to be happening, you know? Yeah. Because, of course, what if Winthrop decides that they're going to go full remote like UNC just did? Does that change their decision about this? I mean, I wouldn't necessarily think so. You know, I talked to Jonathan Poole, the TD for the tournaments, and he said that he actually thinks the fact that Winthrop scaled back and, you know, isn't going to have athletics in the fall is actually helpful for making it possible for the tournament to take place, because the course, Winthrop Gold, if you've never been there, is kind of on the same property as a lot of the athletic fields for Winthrop. So normally, there's lots of student athletes and spectators and other people coming to things that are nothing to do with the disc golf tournament. And the fact that those people aren't going to be there now makes it easier to have this event happen and, you know, not feel like there's too many people congregating.
Certainly. And it still provides a revenue opportunity as well. I mean, you know, I'm not trying to take a cynical view at all, but you still got to make money.
Right.
And you're
right.
Losing out on ticket sales. You're losing out on concession sales. You're losing out on, you know, merchandise and ancillary industry profitability. Like, they are going to need something to try to cut into that deficit at least a little bit. So if disc golf can prove a model that doesn't, you know, cause clusters to come about or doesn't show an increase in cases in the areas that it goes, then look, we're walking a thin line with disc golf, certainly, because through no fault of any of the players or tour staff or anybody's actions, it could happen. Like, I don't know, I love watching Hard Knocks on HBO.
Sure.
And they're doing Los Angeles, both the Chargers and the Rams this year.
Okay.
And they had it happen. They had one of the coaching staff come down with it after doing nothing but staying by himself. And, you know, it's actually Rex Ryan's son for all the NFL fans out there, funny enough. But, like, then it turns out to be a false positive. So just think about all of the things that could happen if something like that happened in disc golf. So there's no guarantee, but so far the early results have been really good, you know, that we're doing the proper things that we need to do to keep the sport going.
Yep.
And I'm quite sure that in this instance, Winthrop's very happy to be able to say that, to go to the local government and say, hey, look, these people are going to come in and be responsible. You know, they've been putting this into practice in other states and they haven't seen problems. Like, man, I don't mean this in a bad way at all, but like, disc golf has really shined through this pandemic so far in the way we've handled ourselves and proven that we can make the necessary adjustments and get buy-in and cooperation, like from the pros on down, and have a good season.
And from, and, you know, governments and
yeah.
local authorities. And no, it's true. I mean, if you'd asked me in March whether I thought we would have this level of success with the disc golf season, there's no way I would have said yes.
I recall you didn't think there was going to be a tour, which I can't blame you for thinking that back then.
I may well have said exactly that. I mean, and you know, obviously there's been huge impacts. We've got, you know, multiple majors canceled, no national tour, but the pro tour has really done a good job. I mean, I there's no way to look at this any other way, I don't think. I mean, to be able to have all of your events taking place with minimal disruption, with you know, an ever increasingly high quality broadcast happening, more people signing up to watch, interest in the sport exploding right now, and you know, to have at this point, as Jeff Spring told me when I talked to him last week, zero reported COVID cases of any players or anybody involved with the tour. What a home run. I mean, you don't want to count your chickens because it's a virus, you know, like it's pretty relentless as we've seen, but so far so good. And you know, now they've got a good plan in place for Vermont, because you know, the Northeast states, Vermont and Massachusetts, for Green Mountain and MVP Open, have much more strict quarantine rules than a lot of states right now. So if you're coming from outside of the region, basically, you got to quarantine for 14 days, or in the case of Vermont, 7 days plus a negative COVID test. So, you know, there's various ways that players can approach this. I wrote an article about it. You can check it out on the website. But, you know, the Pro Tour and Smuggler's Notch, the resort that hosts the GMC, they've subsidized heavily the cost of lodging for players who decide they want to go up to Vermont and do their quarantine up at the resort. So it's, you know, fairly inexpensive for players to get a condo that has a kitchen, that they could get groceries delivered, and they even have a chance to have essentially a bubble to go play the courses and practice, where they shut down the whole course except for players who are in quarantine. So it's a pretty cool situation, and you know, so far so good for the Pro Tour.
Yeah, and if it just culminates at Winthrop at the end of the year and we can actually host a major with the, you know, broadcast on site, at least that's my understanding that the plan is. I actually am looking forward to some of those talks coming up very, very soon. But assuming we don't do too much different other than the necessary differences between 2019 and 2020, what a feather in the cap it'll be just for the entire sport. The fact that we could run an entire tour. I mean, obviously we lost the national tour, but the factors that went into that decision make sense, especially in hindsight. It makes sense that they made that decision. Pro Tour was able to find a way through it. We can still at least host one major. Like, all things considered, in 2020, this could be a big win. You know, knock on wood, fingers crossed that we get through this last stretch of, you know, 6-7 weeks here. But this really could be a very good thing for disc golf. So just shout out to everybody that is, like, I know it sucks to not be able to go spectate. I know it sucks to, like, not be able to interact with the top level players who are always so down to, like, be a part of the bigger community. But thank you to everybody who's cooperated for the most part and just allowed this to keep going.
You know, I'll also say this, and I know part of it is because of the way this season was condensed since we lost, you know, 3 months for COVID. But the pace of tournament play in terms of, like, the scheduling on the calendar has felt so good this year. There's time off. You don't have to be paying attention every single weekend. But there's also enough events to feel like you're getting a sense of the rhythm of the season. We've had so many great close contests. We've had so many different winners across MPO and FPO. And we still have, what, 3 more Pro Tour events plus the championship plus USDGC and the Women's National Championship?
Isn't that nuts?
That's crazy. And, you know, but it's felt really good. I think there's lots of things to be learned from this year. Not just, it's all COVID and let's get back to the way things were. No, I actually think that some of the things about this season worked really well and should be considered. I mean, nothing more than the fact that the Pro Tour was the only show in town and it went well. I mean, again, the season's not over yet, but it's going well. I'll say that. One of the things that we're probably going to see at USDGC Women's National Championship, if it happens, is split broadcasts. MPO, FPO, shown as entirely separate broadcasts with FPO in the morning and the MPO in the afternoon. That's the plan right now, as far as I understand it. That is actually something we saw this past weekend at Ledgestone, which is a departure from the typical live coverage that we've had on the Pro Tour this year, which has been a blended style where the lead card of MPO tees off, and then a couple hours later, the FPO lead card tees off, and the broadcast goes from MPO and kind of picks up FPO as it's in motion in the front nine. Jamie, obviously you're a broadcaster here. You have your own preferences. What do you think? Did you like the split this weekend, or do you think it works better in the new style where it's been blended into one broadcast?
For me personally, and I actually haven't seen all of the numbers from this weekend yet, so that will factor into how I feel about things. Obviously, you want the best for the broadcast. So keep that in mind. I haven't seen a good set of numbers to do, like, data comparison on how many people are watching and time, length of time they're tuning in, all that yada, yada, yada. But just from my personal standpoint, I like the new format better, where we start with MPO and we do the combined show. Let's call it that. I think the combined show is a more interesting product for people to digest and to watch. I do think it is also helping put a spotlight on FPO, and I think more people are giving FPO a chance, which, frankly, they should be, because, you know, let's just be frank. It's just, they're awesome. They're playing better and better and better. And the skill level that we're seeing out of the FPO division is worth watching this year. It really is. So I'm a fan of all that. I will say that despite the challenges of doing the two separate shows, and I think this was tremendously aided by Sunset Hills being the course that we did the broadcast for in the morning, that was probably the best FPO coverage that we've done all year. So I think, you know, that it's the better product. But if you're the hardcore fan that just wants to see all of the possible golf from all of the possible players, well, you got to have your cake and eat it this weekend.
It's an interesting dilemma. There's the argument that putting the FPO into the broadcast during the sort of the end of the MPO round, when you would expect viewership to be at its highest, kind of gets more people involved in the FPO story, and maybe they stick around to continue watching after the end of the MPO round. But at the same time, that does mean that you sort of necessarily give short shrift to the FPO, you know, the start of the FPO round in comparison to the MPO round. And so, you know, balancing that is actually an interesting question. And I think looking at the numbers from this weekend would be worthwhile, because and trying to, if you can, dig into the data and see, like, what was concurrent viewership like, you know, what once the MPO round ends, what are we seeing? How many people are sticking around for the FPO round versus what was it like when we had it completely separate? I think there's arguments to be made on both sides. I think, you know, obviously fans of the FPO game are going to say, I want to watch the whole round. I don't want to watch only the last 12 holes in full and have to, you know, see some shots, but then also go back and hear from the MPO winner, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, on the other hand, the MPO gets more viewership. So how do you balance those competing, you know, factors when you're deciding what you're going to do with the broadcasts for, let's say, next year? I don't think it's an obvious answer. I think that there's a lot of things that sort of make the current combined broadcast a little bit smoother. It's easier for the broadcasters. It maybe keeps people engaged more in the sort of single show, as opposed to feeling like they have to tune in twice. You know, you get better time slots because everything's in the afternoon. You do have the trade-off of not giving as much focus to FPO throughout the entire round.
That's a great summation of the big dilemma of live coverage. Now, think about it this way. Live coverage is at a crossroads in this sport. Traditionally, live coverage and post-produced coverage have been competing, right? You have a quote-unquote live card. You're going to follow that card. What's the difference in what Smashbox was doing 3-4 years ago and what Jomez was doing 3-4 years ago? One was live, one was post-cut. Now, and I'm not talking about the product itself. I'm talking about the intent of the show, the direction of the show. It was meant to be live, but it wasn't done like a golf broadcast, like the popular, I believe it's called the Tarkanian broadcast, but it what was popularized starting in the like late 50s, early 60s, and that's the golf broadcast that we know today, where you have multiple commentators on the course, you go around to multiple holes, blah, blah, blah. You get to see a story. So what you're seeing right now from the Disc Golf Network, and I can tell you this from being in the meetings, we are trying to concoct a certain story, and that's going to make some people upset. Because what they're tuning in for is, in lieu of Jomez, I'm going to watch the live because I'm going to watch all the shots from this card. And so they hear, oh, MPO and FPO, and like, oh, great, we're going to get all the shots from the card. Well, that wasn't anything, that was not a stated goal of this broadcast. And it's not our goal. Our goal is to, when you sit down, deliver you a story. You don't have to worry about the upshot that Sarah Hokum threw on hole 4 when her shot hit the first tree on a hole that she should be in circle 2 on. Our argument is that you don't need to see that shot. If I come back to you on the green, if I come back to Sarah Hokum on the green and she's putting, I can just tell you in 5 words, oh, she threw her upshot to here. If it's an amazing upshot, then we're going to do our best to show it, as we have been doing more and more. Like, just a moment ago, this happened. Now, there's some technology factors in that we're working to improve so we can do more of that, but that's what we're trying to do right now. So with the goal being different, the goal is just to tell a story of the round, because we know our post-produced partners have all of the shots if you want to go back and watch those. And you can go back and watch them in 45 minutes to an hour, a whole round. So instead of saying, hey, let's compete with that, we're just saying, let's do something different. And I think that's why the combined show works so well. And
I will say, as a golf fan and a disc golf fan, I want to see shots. I want to see shots. So while I completely understand the logic behind that, at the end of the day, especially like for a final round, and maybe I should specify, like, what you do in rounds one and two,
yes,
maybe it makes more sense to have that combined effort where it's just like, you know, we're kind of like showing some players and we got the, like, trying to figure out what the stories are going to be for the weekend. By the time you get to the final round, you got a pretty good sense of who's in a position to win, of what the stories are, of what we need to be paying attention to. At that point, I'm interested perhaps in saying, all right, now we're going to split the broadcasts so we can see all of the shots, or at a minimum, like, wait for the FPO lead card to go off until the MPO round is done. I mean, hell, they do this in big pro sports where they hold a basketball game for a doubleheader. They wait 10 or 15 minutes after the scheduled start time in order to make sure that they get the tip on TNT at, you know, after the other game's over. So I don't know. I think there's room to kind of think about both models. But like, I, as a fan of golf and disc golf, I want to watch the shots. Yes, I appreciate the storylines and all that, but I want to see them throw the shots, including the ones that they throw into the tree. And, you know, no one is ever talking about not showing the MPO shots. It's only not showing the FPO shots. And that's where I have a problem with it, because I want to be able to watch the most consequential round, at least, with the full context. I don't want to wait until tomorrow to watch it on the you know, on YouTube. I want to watch it live. Like, that's what, as a consumer of disc golf, I want. And I imagine there are many like me, because, you know, you see this all the time in golf, people getting super annoyed because one of the broadcasters is like showing pre-produced segments and, you know, going to the booth a bunch and not showing people hitting the golf ball. And I don't want to see disc golf befall the same fate. At the end of the day, like, watching the players throw their shots is the core element of what we want from a broadcast.
I don't know that I'm with you on that. I'll be totally honest, because I'm going to use an example just from this, not this past weekend, but the weekend before.
Okay.
The PGA Championship at Harding Park, right?
Yep.
You had a scenario where there were a ton of players in the mix. I think there were 12 players.
It was insane.
Within two strokes of the lead on the final round, which, by the way, if you're not a PGA fan, that doesn't normally happen. There are not that many people in contention.
True.
In that close. Like, normally, if there's that many people in contention, you had leaders, plural, falling off. But you had a ton of players in there. One of them, Brooks Koepka. If you're following golf, you know that dude's a major killer. He's got multiple in a row at some of these majors, including the U.S. Open, the PGA Championship. So what happens to Brooks Koepka in the final round? He's in like the last pairing or second to last pairing, something like that, and he starts falling off. Guess who you didn't see on that broadcast anymore? You only saw Brooks Koepka, and who was he playing with? He might have been playing with Scottie Scheffler, young kid. I'm trying to remember exactly who. I saw a lot of golf and disc golf last week. But you saw his playing partner, who I believe was Scheffler, and then you just saw Koepka like in the background of the shots. They didn't cut to him anymore. And I'm sure there were Brooks Koepka fans that were like, oh man, I really want to see Brooks Koepka's shots. But he was inconsequential to what happened on that final round.
I don't, is this disproving what I just said? I don't think so. I want to see the players who are in contention.
Right. So, but if they're hitting all the trees and they play themselves out of contention, that's a different thing.
But also, golf and disc golf are very different because of how many cameras they have and because of how much they can basically show you any shot at any time on the course.
Right.
And in disc golf, we have to focus on following the lead card or the chase card. Sure.
Yeah.
You're not wrong. Like, if a player, if there's three players at the top and then the fourth player on the lead card is 10 strokes back or something crazy like that, yeah, I don't need to see all their shots. I'm not arguing for, like, give me every single shot of everyone on the lead card and that's it. No, in fact, mm-hmm. I am of the opinion that, you know, peeling a camera off to go follow somebody who's making a run is the right thing to do. Remember, it was a total nightmare at USDGC last year when, you know, all of this action is happening on the chase card and we're seeing basically none of it. And yeah, that was horrible. That was horrible for the broadcast. And so I'm saying that I don't want to like watch an interview and miss shots that are happening because I'm watching an interview. If that makes sense.
Totally.
I'm not saying you need to show me everybody who's on the lead card. In fact, just the opposite. I want to watch the consequential shots that are happening from the players in the mix, even if they're bad shots.
Totally. Oh, 100% with you on that. 100%. And that's something that it's amazing, too, how quickly we can go to having these discussions from just a couple years ago in live broadcast and disc golf, when we're just talking about, like, can they please play on a course where we can see the entire round and they don't have to shut the cameras down for two holes?
Can you get some better reception for your cell uplink? Yeah.
And look, and, you know, thank God for technology. Thank God for, you know, people behind the scenes sticking it out throughout the years and not giving up when they encounter those problems to get to this point. But it's great how quickly we can go from those conversations to, well, I want to debate about how the broadcast is done, you know, and I'm talking about from fans too. There's some fans out there that don't like the mix of MPO and FPO in the combined shows, or they have a problem with us doing one thing versus another. And hell, we're not perfect. I tell everybody when we do our meetings, we go, we're not perfect. We're not right. We're not showing the definitive story of what happened. We're out here to capture the best story we can and just shoot above our rating each day, just like the players. So, but it, you know, the kind of in context of the whole discussion, whether you like the split show, whether you like the combined show, I just think it's awesome that we can have that as the focus of the conversation. We're not talking about generators and battery deliveries. We're not talking about, you know, bed sheets. We're not talking about cell reception and what courses should be played. We are talking about what's on the screen, and that's a win in my book.
Now, you mentioned Sunset Hills. Do you think this is the best FPO course on tour?
Hands down. I mean, name a course that shows off the skill set of the division better. And even if you don't want to approach it from like a course design perspective, just think of it from an entertainment factor perspective. We had 3 chain outs for aces in 2 rounds. We had eagles, bogeys, double bogeys, triple bogeys. We had bad shots gone good, good shots gone bad, lead changes. Like, we had so many of these players shooting under par. It was, honestly, if I got to get up at 6:45 in the morning and call golf, that is the time our show started. Give me Sunset Hills. It's pretty. It's interesting scoring for the skill level, and, you know, frankly, it was just a lot of fun, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the biggest thing, is that you want a course that's going to allow players to be aggressive and to get birdies and to have risk reward. And it's the fact is that not all of the FPO layouts on tour really provide that. That's just a fact. And, you know, for some of the things that Ledgestone does that annoy me, this is not one of them. I'm glad that they have like opted for different courses to showcase players at the level that they need the course to be at. So I think it's really refreshing to see that, and to see, you know, players getting birdies that are not just in the, you know, top 5 highest rated. I think that really makes for a much more compelling overall, not just broadcast, but tournament.
Totally. And I'm sorry to say this, but like, as bad as Northwood is, at least from the show's perspective, Sunset Hills is so good.
Well, we're going to talk about Northwood and Hole 12 and the backups in our subscriber bonus segment. So let's hold that conversation for then.
Sounds good.
But, you know, overall, I think an exciting event this weekend. I do want to quickly say there was like some blowback for Ledgestone and Nate Heinold for like not properly posting on Instagram fast enough that Ricky was the champion and that, like, congratulating him. Look, as somebody who's done a lot of events and like done literally explicitly media for events, you know, when you're at the end of a an event or like there's a lot going on, sometimes you're going to not post a social media post. And to me, it's not some grand conspiracy that Nate Heinold, as a, you know, Discraft representative, is slighting Ricky by not posting about the fact that he won. It that's some real conspiracy theory, tinfoil hat kind of stuff. And to me, that it's, you know, sure, probably should have gotten to it sooner. But when you're focusing on the things that you need to do to actually run the event, sometimes little stuff like that gets missed.
I hate even engaging with this stuff anymore. There's disc golf fans out there that if you ask them, hey, would you ever run your tournament like this? They're like, no. I'd congratulate the winner and I wouldn't care who they were sponsored by. And then 5 minutes later, they're on some Instagram comment section going, oh, Innova hates Eagle McMahon and Discraft hates Ricky Wysocki and like all this other stuff. And it's like, if you wouldn't do it, give those other people the benefit of the doubt. Like, how dumb do you think, like, if this was a Discraft thing and one day Ricky was disillusioned with Innova, do you think they would have wanted to intentionally slight him? Do you think they took their time to intentionally slight Macbeth when he was at Innova? No. These people are not, they're not dumb. They're not doing these scorched earth business tactics just to needle their rivals. Like, that's so petty. These people are out there running, like, what's the payout on this event? $100,000? By the way, Nate Heinold, great job. Nate Heinold's staff, everybody that contributed even a penny to giving the St. Jude Children's Research Hospital $60,000 this weekend.
Wow.
Kudos. Social media post, whatever. $60,000 went to kids with cancer that are never going to have to pay for their treatment. That's awesome. Congrats. Seriously.
Yeah. I mean, listen, on this point, I agree. However, I also think pettiness is a thing in disc golf. And you got to keep your hackles up because even the big manufacturers can pull off some real petty stuff. It definitely is a thing. It definitely is a thing.
Even UltiWorld can get accused of liking certain people over other people and favoring. Like, it's the silliest thing sometimes.
That's how it goes on the internet. I get it. All right. Well, we get a week off here. I guess we get 2 weeks off, right? We have two weekends.
Yeah, with the reschedule
off, everybody gets a chance to take a breather, to quarantine before the start of the Green Mountain Championships in 2.5 weeks, and then right after that, we head on to the MVP Open. And then you got just about a month until USDGC at that point, so. Got a little time to catch our breath, so I'm probably going to do a mailbag show here pretty soon.
We do have some good mail.
We have some. We haven't touched it for a while, and we get some more. Email us, upshot@ultiworld.com, and get us your thoughts on this weekend, the tour this season, what's going on with COVID right now, the explosion in disc golf, whatever's on your mind. We are taking mail of all types. Don't miss our subscriber bonus segment this week where we talk about Northwood. Hole 12, and the backups. Some very brutal backups. And we need to address that problem. It was a sore spot on the Ledgestone experience for sure. So Jamie and I will talk about the hole, the design of the hole, how to solve the backup problem, and more in our subscriber-only bonus segment. You can become a subscriber for less than $4 a month. discgolf.ultiworld.com/subscribe. For Jamie Thomas, I'm Charlie Eisenhood saying so long, and we'll talk to you next week right here on The Upshot.
See ya.